Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Sometimes I'll be like, okay, Saturday evening, I'm going to block out that time to write music. And I think it kind of makes it seem like, okay, if it's scheduled, then my brain is going to prepare for that. And honestly, like, I get in there and I just, like, I don't know, I end up just looking at YouTube the whole time.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Isaac Butler.
And I'm your other host, Karen Hahn.
Hey, Karen, I feel like it has been forever since we've shared hosting duties.
Yeah.
How have you been? How you doing?
I've been pretty good. I've missed you, obviously. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You know, mid-semester, got lots of papers to grade.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what you gonna do? So who do we hear from at the top of this episode?
So that was Cameron Liu, the genius behind the American indie soul music project Ginger Root. He recently released a new EP called Nisemono, and I thought that was as good an excuse as any to get him on the show because I am a big fan of his music and music videos.
That sounds great. If you're a Slate Plus member, do you get something extra this week or what?
Oh my gosh, yes. We actually have a lot of goodies for the Slate Plus segment this week because our conversation was so great. We talk about Cameron transitioning out of having a day job while starting to work on Ginger Root and how he balanced the two things in the meanwhile, and also when he first became interested in music and started to kind of pursue it more seriously. So there is a lot to look forward to in the Slate Plus segment this week.
That's wonderful. And if you're a Slate Plus member, you'll have that waiting for you at the end of this week's episode. If you're not a Slate Plus member, I mean, why don't you just pause this and sign up right now? And then you could get access to that. You could get full access behind the paywall of our mothership site, slate.com, which you may have heard of. You get bonus episodes of other shows. You get so much stuff. All you got to do is go to slate.com/workingplus to sign up today. Now, let's take a listen to Karen Hahn's conversation with Cameron Liu, a.k.a. Ginger Root.
Hello, Cameron. Thank you so much for coming on to Working.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to chat. I don't get to chat very often about all this stuff, so I'm very excited.
Well, it's our honor to have you on then, because I'm such a huge fan of your music. And I wanted to start off by talking about your new EP, Nisemono. What I really find remarkable about it is that you built this entire story around and through it. And I was hoping just for our listeners, if you could explain kind of the plot of the EP and also what inspired you to build an EP this way.
Sure, absolutely. So the whole concept of the EP is the year is like 1984. Ginger Root is brought in to write songs for an up-and-coming Japanese pop idol, Kimiko Takaguchi.
Mm-hmm.
She's having her American debut, and the song I wrote for her, she's going to sing on this like fictitious late-night show. But because of the pressure, she quits right before her debut. Her manager runs up to me and is like, yo, you wrote the songs. You got to sing them because you know them. And then I'm thrusted into this spotlight, and then the EP follows that journey of like this unexpected rise to kind of unwanted stardom, I guess, unexpected, and then kind of the trials that come with that. And the story is actually still continuing through like the music videos and stuff. I have yet to make them or conclude them, but there is an ending. And once I have a little bit more free time after tour, I will conclude the EP story. But yeah, that's kind of what it's about.
So when you were coming up with the story, like did the idea of the story come first, or did you have like some songs beforehand where you're like, oh, I feel like these kind of tied together in this thematic way?
I definitely had like a lot of demos, but not like a clear vision.
Mm-hmm.
But I think ultimately it was the idea of this like fictitious, you know, pop idol. And if I wrote the songs for her, and it was kind of like this way of being able to pretend I wasn't Ginger Root for a second, and like being able to kind of explore maybe a different style of writing. And it kind of helped me write all the songs. And then it, you know, once each song kind of started to form together and come in, that's really when the whole specifics of the world and the idea really just came together all at once.
And you actually did a sort of similar thing with your 2021 EP, City Slicker, where it's structured kind of around a story, although in that time it was around this fictional film.
Yeah.
I think that's the first time that you went this kind of narrative route for an EP or album. What was the initial, I guess, kind of inspiration for you to think, oh, like, I want to structure my work in this way?
My previous records before City Slicker definitely had, like, thematic, you know, elements to it, but it wasn't very narrative-driven.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think the record that I put out during the pandemic, Ricky, you know, selfishly, I thought that that was the record that was going to break, you know, and I thought I put a lot of work into it and I had high hopes for it. And that was kind of the first time I had those feelings and I really felt confident in it. And just because of the state of the world, and I think just because of what the record was, I think maybe a little too personal or something, or all these outside factors, you can never tell. It just didn't really perform as well as I thought it was going to be. And so when it came time, you know, where I was like, what do I want to do next? I kind of shifted my perspective of being like, let me just make kind of like a world that's like totally made up that I'd like to live in. And let me make kind of a thing that's a little bit more, I think, positive or upbeat or fun for people where they can buy in and they can envelop themselves into this narrative for like a quick 15 to 20 minutes. And then, you know, hopefully that could provide basically an escape, because I think at that point when I was writing stuff, like I wanted to make an escape for myself, you know, through the music. And I think that's really where I figured out that I wanted to maybe make something more narrative that came along with the project. And so I think it was a combination of things, but I ended up having a lot of fun with City Slicker in terms of making this world and world building and this universe building, if you want to call it that. And I decided to continue that on Nisei Mono.
That's awesome. And I actually want to jump on a quick tangent just based on what you were saying about the perceived success of Ricky. It's sort of something that I think it's hard to not talk about in a creative field, where it's like there's what you consider as like creative success, where it's like I'm proud of this thing that I made and I think it's good, versus like a, I guess, a broader success of like how does an audience receive it. So what for you like is success on that front?
Yeah, absolutely. Ricky was kind of my real second album. So with my first record, Mahjong Room, it was kind of like, I'm going to make a record. Like, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to, like, let it fly, you know? And when it was time to make Ricky, or when I was making Ricky, that took 2.5 years. And I think I fell into the trap of, like, I need this to be, like, vacuum tight. Like, I need this to be, like a really, like, important project that means a lot for me. And I think I got maybe too involved with the expectations. And because it was so long, like, of a process, my expectations grew. And I think just as a creative, like, it's hard not to kind of get into that headspace, you know? I think that's just part of the creative process. And so when, you know, baking Ricky and making Ricky, like, you know, over that long period of time, I think I lost a sense of why I started Ginger Root in the first place. And and I am very proud of Ricky. I really think that's a special album to me. And I think maybe, you know, to answer a part of your question is, you know, I'm very happy with the way it turned out. And I think that's the most important. But just as a creative, just naturally, of course, like reception is kind of just a part of, you know, being creative and artistry. And I think as a musician, if, you know, no one's really listening, it hurts a little bit.
So to bring it back to Nisei Mono, how long did this EP take you to put together?
In terms of like songwriting, mixing, I think just like from the audio standpoint and like the music standpoint, maybe like 5 months or something like that. And then the videos kind of waterfalled with the singles. So, you know, with the album release, I think as a whole from like start date to release date, it was under a year, I'd say.
Wow. And I definitely want to talk about the music videos because I'm obsessed with them. But to start with the songwriting process, is there a typical, I guess, process for you when it comes to writing songs? Like, do lyrics come first? Does the melody come first? Or does it kind of depend from song to song?
I normally start with the music. So I'll be poking around at a guitar or a keyboard, and something will kind of pique my interest, and I'll kind of write on that for a little bit. I've gone back and forth between like the idea of like, oh, if it's in the moment, like just keep going, even if I'm tired, or if it's late at night, or I need to do something else, like just keep writing it. And then also going between like, okay, I got like one idea, I'm going to let it sit. So in terms of that, it's been kind of a rolling process, but normally it's music first. I'll write a full demo where it's just keys, bass, and drums, because I know that's what we have to play live. So I want to kind of make sure that the song can stand with those three core elements, because there's only three of us on stage. And then I'll usually finish that. I'll let that sit. And then I'll come back to it and actually relearn it, like if I had to play it live, so then I play it better. I'll make this whole thing with like synths and everything, where like just the ideas are there. It might be rough, but like the new ideas are there, the new layers are there, the new textures are there. I'll let that sit, and then I'll come back and I'll basically re-record everything and have this like idea of like, okay, I got to get everything in one take, because I want to make sure like it's as clean as possible. So like I'll rehearse everything before I'll take it, and usually vocals and lyrics are like last.
And I noticed that you play all the instruments yourself on the EP. Is this always how you do it?
Yeah, I write and record and produce and perform everything you hear on the EP.
That's amazing. And I know you've spoken, I think, about it before, in that it tends to work that way just because your process is kind of, as you were saying, a bit like flow of the moment. Like if you're in the flow, then you just want to keep doing it. And sometimes it makes it hard to, I guess, collaborate with other artists like in the songwriting process. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about, I guess, achieving that flow and also your thoughts or experiences working with other artists, because again, you have two other people that you tour with, but in recording it is just you.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of like hitting that flow and getting in that mindset, like when either like making music or any part of the EP, like, you know, figuring out the stories for the music videos, editing, or even like designing merch or whatever, like any part of the creative process, like I think first with specifically with music, I have learned over, you know, the years of doing this, and then like kind of the other bands I used to be in too, is like you can't schedule when that flow is going to come. I think like sometimes I'll be like, okay, Saturday evening, I'm going to block out that time to write music. And I think it kind of makes it seem like, okay, if it's scheduled, then my brain is going to prepare for that. And honestly, like there are times where that works. Like I've tried it, and, you know, I'll be like, okay, that was like a cool session. Like, and then sometimes I get in there and I just like, I don't know, I end up just looking at YouTube the whole time or something, and like nothing. And I feel bad or whatever. And then other times, like I'll be poking around like on this like really bad guitar I have in middle school. And then like in 5 minutes, I'm like, that's a song. That's weird. Like, and I'll voice memo it, and then I'll drive to the studio, and I'll like keep humming it on the way or something. So yeah, it's, I think what I've learned is like, it's unpredictable. When the time comes where you're in that moment, I think do whatever you can to stay in there, because for me, and everyone's different, but for me, I feel like it's a very special moment that's where I think things, you know, are created. And I think if you can get into that headspace, you should stay there for as long as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that's the idea of the muse, where it's like it'll come to you when it wants to. And then you have to kind of take advantage of that time rather than hoping that you can plan it out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you say that too, because, you know, I was trying to think of like creative solutions for like a video or like this one part of the song. And I remember like working on it every day for, I think, maybe like a week straight, and just, I came up with these ideas, but I was not happy with like any of them. And I remember just like taking a few days off where I didn't even think about it. I think I tried to do something else, or I just like, I don't know, I just kind of let it sit on the shelf for like a weekend or something like that.
Yeah.
Did not think about it at all. And I came back and my brain was like, oh, you should just do this. And I was like, why didn't I think about that in the first place? So I think another part of the process is like, let things sit. Like they say, my friend says, remember the phrase like sleep on it. Like that's an actual thing. And I'm a believer now after that. So.
I think that's a good actionable piece of advice. Thank you.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you, how did you end up sort of coming up with your sound or your aesthetic, as it were? Because you self-describe as, quote unquote, aggressive elevator soul, which is a description I really, really love. I was hoping you could break that down in terms of sound as well as like influence, as well as like how you came to that as, I guess, your label, as it were.
Specifically with like the actual phrase aggressive elevator soul, I remember we were opening at some local bar, and this guy who I believe was very drunk came up and was like, "Oh, you guys are amazing. Like, I felt like so chill. I was like in an elevator the whole time, but it was so loud. So it was like aggressive, man. But man, you guys got soul because whatever." And I remember just piecing together. I'm like, "Oh, so like aggressive elevator soul." He's like, yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, like that. And I was like, "That's a great term. I'm going to steal that. Thank you."
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where like the term actually came about. In terms of like finding the sound, I think that's something that is an ever evolving journey and an ever evolving process. I think like at first, like it definitely was music. Like if we're talking about like Mahjong Room and Spotlight People, which is like, my very first record under Ginger Root, like I think it was all a process of actually playing and writing songs that were completely different than the stuff I was writing and playing with at the time. You know, I was playing like a lot of guitar based music, like jangle pop stuff, power pop, or like psych pop stuff. And I just wanted to maybe write songs that were outside my comfort zone. And so I started playing around with keyboards and everything. And I think that will always be a fundamental of Ginger Root, is like a synth sound and a keyboard sound. I think that's something that still stayed like throughout all these like albums, but I think it's always like an ongoing journey.
Yeah.
But I think something that stays the same is like I kind of grew up listening to like Motown stuff, and there's definitely something, a groove element to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in high school I learned about like power pop, so like Electric Light Orchestra, XTC, you know, Paul McCartney's solo career, you know,
yeah.
or, you know, stuff like that. And I think all those combine, in addition to also like finding out about the whole world of like Japanese music in high school, like I think all those three avenues generally are what influences Ginger Root's sound.
Yeah. And of course, we also have to talk about the name Ginger Root. You've told the story of the name before, that it came from, it was inspired by a Wolfpack performance. But
yes.
I wanted to know specifically what made you decide to take a sort of stage name or band name rather than just going by your name, Cameron Liu.
I think, to be completely honest, I wasn't sure if I wanted to turn Ginger Root into a band later down the road.
Okay.
And I really am not a fan of like so-and-so and the so-and-sos, you know, or whatever,
yeah.
you know, like that type of band. I didn't want to like attach that later down the road. So I also, to be honest, like I felt like if I used my name, it'd be even more personally attached to me, you know, because it's like, it is Cameron Liu, like Cameron Liu makes this music.
Yeah.
And I felt like I wasn't super confident in what I was doing. I didn't know if Ginger was going to stick around or whatever. And I think like I wanted to maybe try to take some of the weight off and take some of the pressure of being like, oh, this is a project and this is a moniker, versus like this is all riding on like one person's shoulders because it's like the person's name or something like that.
We'll be back with more of Karen's conversation with Cameron Liu after this.
What's the best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day in everyday situations. But if that's not on the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. I've used apps in the past to learn new languages, but when I came across Babbel, I wondered if it could help me refresh my knowledge of a language I once spoke well, but was now a little bit or quite a lot rusty. I have to say, I was impressed. The advanced lessons were really useful, tips and idioms that can help with in-depth conversations on topics that I can actually imagine chatting about. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations, and the tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. What's more, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited time deal for working listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for working listeners, at babbel.com/working. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/working, spelled BABBEL.com/working. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, listeners, it's Isaac Butler here. Just wanted to say a couple things real quick. First of all, if you're listening to this podcast, but you do not subscribe to it, why don't you go to your podcast doohickey app thingamajig and click subscribe. And if there's some method of rating us, like stars on the Apple Store or a check mark or a stamp of approval, something, if you could do that too, that helps us find new listeners. We also would love to hear from you. If you've got a question you want to ask us, a guest you'd like to see, maybe you've done something creatively awesome that you want to share with your fellow listeners, well, drop us a line at working@slate.com or leave us a voicemail at 304-933-WORK. All right, now let's listen to the rest of Karen's conversation with Cameron Liu.
So again, I want to talk about the music videos, and because the music videos that you've produced are really, really incredible. They are so polished, and they're so fun to watch. The storytelling is so great, and so is the production. Can you tell me a little bit about where the creative process starts for a music video?
Yeah. So I went to Chapman and I majored in film production as an editor. And yeah. And before I did Ginger Root, or like also while I was doing Ginger Root when it first started, I was freelance editing. So I think like my foundation comes from that in terms of, I also think like for narrative, like wanting mm-hmm. to have the EP be narrative, I think comes mm-hmm. from a film background mm-hmm. that I have. But in terms of like the process, you know, it's different for every song, but most of the time I'll be like, at that demo stage where it's like all the layers are there, but it's a little rough and I want to retake mm-hmm. vocals or something. That's usually when I'm listening to that version over and over again, there's these little bits and pieces of like ideas for scenarios or scenes that would slowly come about. And I think for this EP in particular, because I had this like premise, I'm like, okay, it's like 1984 there. I'm like writing a song for an idol. I had that kind of like foundation to go off. And I think once the song started to roll in, I was like, oh, there should be a video where like I'm the spokesperson for these commercials, or there should be a video where like, you know, I'm performing on late night, or there should mm-hmm. be a part where like I go on vacation, or, you know, and all these things slowly piece together into this, I think, big overarching storyline. And then once the songs were like pretty much done, I sat down with my friend David, who helps me with all the videos, and I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. how do we piece together what songs are what scenes and what mm-hmm. songs are what part of this bigger narrative or whatever? And we say, okay, Loneliness, which is the one of the songs on the EP, is like, okay, this is going to be this scene, and this scene. And then from there, it's just like logistically, okay, how do we do that?
Yeah. Speaking of logistics, though, that video has a shot of you or a scene of you at an airfield coming out of a jet, which when I watched it, I was like, holy shit, like, how did you manage this?
Wow, that's a long story in itself. I'll abbreviate it. But basically, that scene of me coming off a jet is a reference to like a clip from 1980. There's this clip from this Japanese music show called Best of 10, where for those who don't know what Best of 10 is, it's basically like every week they list the top 10 songs of like the pop idols of like that week or something like that. And so number whatever was Seiko Matsuda, mm-hmm. who had her debut song, and the clip is literally them just waiting like at the side of the jet. It flies in. She's the first to walk off the plane. They hand her headphones. They're like, all right, sing your song. And then the song just starts.
That's
It's crazy. I it's been taken off YouTube here and there. I've downloaded it for myself because it's just such a special clip. And like, there's like people are trying to leave the plane, and she's just like singing in front of like this jet. So because of the whole theme of like, you know, 80s Japan and like the Showa era and idol culture, I was like, I have to reference this. And when I told David, I was like, I need a plane. He was like, I don't know how we're going to do that. So anyway, we tried to find so many solutions. We're like, you know, we're based out of LA. So we're like, it should be easy. Like people film here all the time. You can find a lot of insides of planes, but not outsides of planes because of like permitting or whatever. Then we tried private jet companies because we figured like, oh, maybe, you know, their planes obviously look good and maybe they'll let us do it or whatever. And unfortunately, because of COVID, private air travel for really rich people have gone up like 600%. So they're like, you can film with the plane, but you have to rent the plane as if you were going to fly it. So obviously out of our budget. Then we went to like a World War II museum who like had their own planes, but they were much cheaper because they're a nonprofit, but cheaper wasn't cheap enough. Thankfully, that guy, one of the people from the private jet company, called us and was like, hey, I'm just checking in. Are you like all good with your shoot? And we're like, no, we can't find anyone. They're like, okay, well, what's your max budget? And we're like, this much, not a penny more. They're like, okay, well, I have a friend who rents his jet out for photo shoots, and it's usually in Paris, but it's here like day you want to shoot. If you call him and he says yes, you can use it. We called, he was super French. He was like, well, what do you want for, you know, whatever. And we're like, you know, we explained the whole thing and like the whole show, the whole reference, and he was like, okay, like he was like, these guys are crazy. And he came back and he's like, yeah, my plane flies in that day. It's got to get washed that night. You can film with it like in the evening, and then it's got to fly out the next day. So if you can make it work, like make it work. He, super, super cheap for what it was. And that is how we found a plane.
That's incredible. I mean, it absolutely is worth it, I think, having watched the video.
It was. It was a crazy experience. Like, shout out Air 7. That for some reason, if people are looking for private jets, Dennis at Air 7 and Matt at Air 7 hooked it up. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's a good shout out to have on this podcast, I think.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to ask, I guess, another production-related question as well. It's like, it seems like you're doing all of this like pretty independently. So when you are kind of planning for these music videos, like how do you decide, like, I won't ask exact numbers as to like what budget you're setting aside, but like how do you budget for this kind of stuff? Because it seems very labor intensive.
Yeah, it definitely is a labor of love. I definitely lose several years off my life every video, you know, but you know, it's for Ginger Root. But I mean, overall, like it's a lot of fun to make. In terms of like logistically doing it, thankfully this round, this cycle for this EP, I've gotten a little bit more funds from Acrophase Records, which is the label I'm on. And so before it was definitely like independent, they'd give me, you know, a couple bucks and stuff. But they are basically like, okay, however many videos you want to make, like this is the chunk of change we can give you. And so it's up to you to figure out, like, obviously like Loneliness took a big portion of that money. But then like me and David tried to figure out like, okay, so for like over the Hill example, like if we could just shoot it all outside, then we don't have to pay for location. We don't have to pay, you know, stuff like that. So definitely it was kind of a juggling act of like, okay, we have this amount of resources and this amount of funds. You know, thankfully, I have David and I have kind of formulated like our go-to crew. And what's really cool is like it's kind of scalable too. So some people understand like, okay, this is the big number. This is the showstopper. So we need all hands on deck, you know, or whatever. And then sometimes it's like, hey, no offense, I can only afford like literally David. So sorry, everyone. And everyone's like, no, we get it. It's cool. So
yeah,
it's been a huge learning experience. And I think whatever the next project's going to be, I think we have more knowledge to figure out how to smoothly make that happen. This whole thing is a learning process, which is what keeps us on our toes and what keeps it fun.
And another thing in terms of, I guess, stuff that you have to plan to do apart from creating music is going on tour. That is also a really huge endeavor to undertake. Like, what is the planning leading up to that? Like, how much, like, when do you think like, oh, I have enough stuff to go tour, I have an idea of like where I want to go, like what is that process?
Thankfully we have a booking agent where they kind of route the whole thing. The tour was kind of planned while the production of the EP was rolling, and so there was this deadline of like, okay, we leave this date, mm-hmm. which means that everything has to be done before then. All the songs has to be learned. You know, me, Matt, and Dylan, who play with me live, you know, we're like in my studio and we're trying to workshop the songs and we're trying to figure out how to play it with only six hands, you know, or mm-hmm. everything like that. It is definitely, yeah, another part of the process. This was our first, I would say, legitimate like headline tour where mm-hmm. it was our shows. We've been in the opening slot for like 4 years, you know, now. And so it was a lot of pressure. It was a lot of nerves. It was a lot of stress trying to figure out, like, are people going to show up? Are people going to know what's going on? And to my surprise, like, people were singing the songs and like people were like, you know, just really into it. And we were selling out places we've never played before. And, you know, that I have to thank that to the YouTube algorithm and like the internet in general still. But like it was really cool because I think, you know, I was talking to Matt and Dylan about this because as an opener, you're kind of, you know, it's a great opportunity. I think mm-hmm. everyone should do it. That's, you know, coming through the ranks. But like there's a point in time where it's really taxing. Like you're there to play a show that no one wants to really hear you, like because they're just here for the next act.
Yeah.
You have to pretend kind of like you're not there. You have to clean up. You have to make sure that, you know, you're not stepping on anyone's toes. And it's a great opportunity. And we definitely kind of went through the ranks and learned how to tour efficiently as a band mm-hmm. and personally, like friendship wise, what space everyone needs, you know, when they mm-hmm. need or whatever. And for the first time when we played like the first couple shows, like that's when I realized like touring, I think for me is maybe one of the most fun parts of doing music. Playing live music, seeing that immediate reaction from someone, like a real person in front of you, whether they like your music, whether you made a mistake, whether you know, whatever, and they're smiling or whatever, they're hanging out with their friends, they're filming it on their phones or whatever. Like, it was such an experience that I forgot about because of the pandemic, one.
Yeah.
And two, I've never experienced it at that level because people were like, yeah, we're here to see you. And we still can't believe it. Like, we end the show, we're like, okay, the next band's going to come up, you know, or whatever. It's really weird. But I think, like, all this is to say, like, the stress of the tour and figuring that out, I think totally does not come close to, like, the positives that come from playing these songs that, you know, I've worked so hard on for the past, you know, whatever, getting to hear them in a venue and getting to share them with the people who are there, I think is maybe the most special part of this whole thing.
Yeah, but it's also a pretty intense experience as well, I imagine. Like, is there any kind of fear of burning out while you're on the road? And I guess on the other side of that question, like, what do you do when you encounter it when you're not on the road? Like, how do you overcome that?
Yeah, absolutely. Burnout for me definitely is really scary because I experienced that with film. You know, when I was in film school, it ruined film for me because I was doing it every day and stuff. And so, granted, I'm still implementing it with Ginger Root, but but yeah, I think like touring is a whole other topic that I could do like a whole seminar about after you know, doing it in different ways. But I think what's really important is to like take care of yourself and mm-hmm. like, it's physically draining. It's mentally draining. I think a lot of other bands will definitely relate to this, but I think people who go to shows maybe don't quite see it because they're like, they come to the venue and like the band plays or whatever. But yeah, it's like we're in one city. We show up. We're there at the venue for like 6 hours. We mm-hmm. sound check. We play the show. We got to throw all that back in the van. And then the next day we do it all again in a city that's like 400 miles away, you know, or something like that. And we do that for 3 weeks straight. And some bands are like road dogs. They do that for like 4 months mm-hmm. straight, like no breaks. And I'm like, more power to you. I don't know how you do that. But yeah, I mean, like in terms of like, you know, experiencing burnout, I think there's this weird thing of like being on the road and wanting to be in the moment and be present and soak in like these experiences you're having and meeting the listeners and everything. But it's like you kind of, we call it like low battery mode. Like you're mm-hmm. just on autopilot. Like you're just trying to get through the shows. And I feel really bad because like I want to enjoy every moment of it. But there's this certain like rut and monotony that happens like in the middle of the tour that I think there's no way to like get out of it. Because it's like the same thing over and over again in the sense of like driving, setting up, playing, tearing down, driving, you know, whatever. And so I think for me, I'm still learning how to maybe cope with that type of burnout or that type of rut on the road. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that's going to be different for everyone. I think like taking walks by yourself or calling your friends and family back home, I think is important. I think like it's okay to like go to McDonald's instead of like the famous, like something that you're just like, I know this is real and I know it's like the same every time, you know, or whatever, I think is a good thing. Yeah, definitely like mental health is really important to keep in track to hopefully not make yourself get to the state of like burnout and fatigue. So,
yeah. And I have a final sort of dangler question, and it doesn't really relate to any of the other questions that I've asked so far, which is you've covered songs like, I'm obsessed with your cover of Cruel Angel's Thesis, and then you also have this cover of Linus and Lucy that's really, really wonderful. How do you choose what songs you want to cover?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of like stuff I grew up listening to and also what's like stuck in my head at that moment, you know? So I think for like Linus and Lucy, there's actually, each of those has their own like reason. Linus and Lucy is because I cannot play it on piano because of the whole like, you got the hand separation thing. So I was like, oh, let me just do it where I'm playing the bass part on bass and then I'll just dub the synth part. Since I was in middle school, I had this friend who could play it and I was always jealous. And I still, to this day, cannot play Linus and Lucy. So I was like, let me make it like a totally different cover with bass instead of keyboard and stuff. So that's that reason. And then for Cruel Angel's Thesis, I just finished End of Evangelion and my mind was
so
blown.
Good.
It's so good. It's so good. And so, yeah, I could only think about that show for like an entire 2 months. So I was like, I gotta cover it.
I mean, your cover is really, really good. And any Evangelion fans, it is on Spotify and on YouTube. You should check it out.
Thank you.
Cameron, thank you so, so much for coming onto the show. This is such a delight.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun chatting.
Karen, I just thought that conversation was delightful. And I thought there was a lot of great advice in that interview and a lot of great kind of perspective on creativity that I just want to make sure we talk about before we leave today. And one of them had to do with creative flow.
Mm-hmm.
For Cameron, it's not really controllable. It's more that you have to capitalize on it when it happens. You know, you have to create the space, clear the decks. I got to stay in this state for as long as possible and not go do my taxes or eat some ice cream or, you know, play some video games or whatever. You know, it's weird though. I remember being able to do that when I was like temping because I just was sitting at a phone all day with nothing to do. But now that I have like 17 jobs and a child and things like that, I find that for myself, my process is much more akin to the one that he was saying he doesn't do. You know, like I try to prime the pump as much as possible so that in the exact scheduled time that I'm sitting down to work, stuff starts firing. Whether that works or not, I don't know. It doesn't always. But like, does that make any sense? Like, what is it like for you? Are you, you know, sitting around waiting for the flow to happen or what?
I want to say that ultimately, I don't think the things that you're talking about are necessarily all that different because it is sort of the same principle, right? Like even if you set aside the time, you don't know that it's going to work.
Yeah,
but
totally.
We all, I think, do that. Like we don't bank it all on thinking like, ooh, I'm sure at one point this week I will get into the flow and be in this creative zone. Like we are still setting aside time every day because that's kind of what you have to do. Like if it is something that you have to keep working on. Like, I don't want to say like if it's a job, but that is ultimately what it is. If it's a job, you kind of have to keep doing some part of it, even if you are hoping that you'll get hit by inspiration at some point. And ultimately, like all of us also have to deal with timing. Like we all have other things to do in our lives besides this creative work, whether it's dealing with family stuff or even stuff as simple as just eating food and sleeping. Like that's time that's being taken up that you can't work. You just hope that you have a good day when you sit down and do work. And obviously on this show, we've talked a lot about how to try to get into a creative headspace or otherwise, again, as you say, like try to prime the pump. But ultimately, it's just figuring out how much you can do to push the scale in one direction or the other.
Yeah, totally, totally. And another thing that's important, which he talks about, and I just have to highlight this because of how often it comes up on this show, you gotta take some goddamn breaks. You gotta create space for your subconscious to do its thing and to knit together the ideas and kind of, you know, just hitting your head against a problem is not actually how you solve it. You have to do some of that, but you also have to create space for your mind to do work that you're not 100% aware of. And so since we talk about it so often on here, I guess I just want to say, it was nice to hear a guest say it.
Yeah, again, it's something we all know, but could definitely benefit from hearing more often. I think the impulse to take breaks is one we generally try to shy away from because time is so precious. And I think a lot of us often make ourselves feel guilty about taking it easy or taking a rest in some way.
I get that way. Protestant work ethic, even though I'm not a Protestant. I also loved how honest he was about his expectations of success and maybe sometimes when he had fallen short of it and how that was difficult for him, you know, that there's two ways you can define success. And to a certain extent, you have to define it in both ways. One is the creativity way and one is the business way. And it sounds a bit like he, because he had gotten so creatively invested in his album, Ricky, he had sort of higher expectations of commercial success for it than how it panned out, but was also happy about now looking back about sort of where he is. You're about to come out with a book. You know, I came out with one earlier this year. I'm just wondering, like, how are you managing setting those expectations of success creatively or commercially for yourself? I mean, you don't have to share what those are. Like, I want to sell a million copies or whatever, but I'm just wondering, like, what's it been like for you?
It's kind of weird. Like, I think I'll just be happy if people I like the book. Like, I think, like, in just like the quote unquote film Twitter sphere, like, if people are like, oh, yeah, it's pretty good, then I will be totally happy with that as like the end of the road.
You'll be happy with pretty good. You'll be happy with people being like, yeah, this book's pretty good.
I just don't want anyone to say anything mean to me. Like, that's really like what will destroy my life. If I see someone be like, this book like kicks rocks, I'll be like, this is the worst day ever. I'm not really thinking about it financially right now, though maybe I will, like when it comes out, or maybe it's closer to the publish date. Again, my book is coming out November 22nd. Please buy it.
November 22nd.
I have no idea like how much my publishers will share numbers with me or what numbers they think of as being successful for a book like mine. Although I do know that there are certain numbers that I have to hit if I want to get paid a little more because I don't get paid per book sold. But yeah, ultimately, it's just like I just hope that the reviews or reception is pretty good.
Yeah.
And I think that's really all. Like, what kind of benchmarks were you setting for yourself when, for instance, like when The Method came out?
Yeah, I didn't want to know sales numbers. I eventually learned what they were. Like a few weeks ago, I was like, all right, now I'm psychically healthy enough that I could just learn what the numbers are. And I wanted to know, I checked in a few weeks after it came out and I was just like, I don't want to know the numbers. Please don't tell me. I just want to know, are you and the publisher happy? I just sent that email to my editor. Are you happy with how sales are going? And he said yes. And so that was of great comfort to me. But the main thing about success, these are the two things. I set these very consciously because when I used to do like low budget theater in basements and stuff, you would just go crazy if you didn't decide in advance what success looked like. Because you just be like, why don't I have an agent and a review in the Times? It's like, well, you didn't send a press release to the Times. That's why you don't know, you know, whatever it is. So obviously I wanted it to have good reviews. I wanted it to be like in the national conversation about acting. You know, because the Oscars were coming up and stuff like that. Like I wanted to intervene in the national conversation around that stuff. And I wanted it to sell well enough that the publisher was maybe interested in another book for me. You know, like that was what I set as the goals. And that happened actually fairly fast, which is great because then it meant that I could just enjoy everything else.
Yeah.
And it's been wonderful since then because I'm like, oh, I did like it did what it needed to do. And everything else is just really delicious gravy. And now I get to point, you know, then of course you get addicted to it, though. And you're like, can I have a gravy hose that is just, you know, it's just gravy, gravy, gravy.
Yeah. That's what the gravy train is all about, actually.
That's what the gravy train's all about. But, you know, there are other expectations I could have had that I didn't. Like, it's going to be a bestseller. It did not make a bestseller list. I'm fine with that because it did the other things that I wanted it to do.
Yeah. I was going to say, you could have fooled me because, like, the reception and, like, critical response around it was so, so good, and popular response, but it was so good that, like, I genuinely thought that it was on a bestseller list.
Well, at least it didn't make the Times list. I don't know about, sure, about others' lists, but you know, like, you actually have to, if you look at the bestsellers for nonfiction for the New York Times, it's like, you know, Hillary Clinton's book, or, you know, I mean, like, it's because it's sort of all nonfiction,
right?
You know,
right,
you're competing with all sorts of crazy stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I will tell you, there was a very funny thing that happened where, speaking of, you know, having sane measures of success, where pretty soon after the book came out, I was a guest on Fresh Air, which was incredible. I mean, that was like a life-changing experience. And someone happened to send me that the book, right after Fresh Air came out, the book was in the top 500 of all books sold on Amazon.
Wow.
Which is crazy, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, a day later, it was much lower than that, or whatever. And so I was talking about that with my editor, and he was like, do not follow your Amazon sales ranking. I've seen it happen.
Ugh.
You will go insane.
That's hilarious.
So I never checked it again on his advice.
Fair.
So anyway, hopefully that will happen to you, and then it will also be a bestseller.
Which part?
All of that. All of that.
Okay, thank you.
Now, here's a question, though, because this was something that was really hard for me when The World Only Spins Forward came out.
Uh-huh.
How wrapped up are you in what, like, Bong Joon-ho and his team think of the book?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I don't know. I actually have to talk to my publishers about that, because we should definitely try to send them a copy, because we talked to his longtime, like, producer about it. I don't know. I think generally, I don't know if he would read it, like, because my impression of hearing stuff through the grapevine about him helping, like, talk to people to get them to talk to us about the book was, he was like, oh, I don't want to do it. Like, why would they talk about me? Like, oh no, please don't. I think he's very shy and very self-effacing.
Right.
So I don't know how much he would actually want to look into it. But the producer, Duho Choi, who was so, so, so helpful to us, I hope he likes it anyway.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, totally. I mean, I was lucky with my book that most of the people that I was writing about are dead. But with The World Only Spins Forward, it was like 250 people we had interviewed who were alive, who could possibly feel aggrieved by how their interviews came out.
I don't think anyone would be aggrieved, hopefully.
No.
Because it's not like I'm writing anything mean about him.
Right.
And also, all of the interviews are with people who want to say nice things about him. So
totally, totally. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. If you like what we do here on Working, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And you know what? It's time for one last Slate Plus pitch. When you join Slate Plus, you get all sorts of goodies, bonus segments on shows like this one, access behind the paywall, a charming weekly newsletter that gives you the inside scoop on Slate, written by a different Slate staffer every week. It's great. You support what we do here on Working, you'll feel like a virtuous person. Go to slate.com/workingplus today to sign up.
Thank you so much to Cameron Liu, a.k.a. Ginger Root, for being our guest this week. And an extra special thank you to another Cameron, our producer, Cameron Drews. We'll be back next week with Isaac's conversation with poet Jay Hopestein. Until then, get back to work.